I'm going to say two words, and I wonder what comes to your mind. Those two words are youth sports. Okay, now there's a chance you thought about your own experience within youth sports, or if you're like me, a parent, you're thinking about what your kids' experience in youth sports has been like. And, you know, we don't do this a ton here on this podcast, but because I'm so passionate about coaching kids, any chance I have to bring on an expert to have a discussion over where we need to be right here in 2024, I'm going to jump at that chance. I encourage everybody to go back and listen to the conversation that we had with Scott Lancaster. Today, we're going to sit down with Luis Fernando Llosa, and this guy is a writer. He's what I would call an activist in youth sports, and he's really trying to help us understand why we need to change the conversation. And the reason that I reached out to him is because I am so passionate about changing the guard with regards to youth sports. Because as great as youth sports has been for so many people, it's a freaking disaster for others. And as a youth coach, I see it firsthand. I can tell you that in my locker room currently, most of the kids are having a pretty good experience, but there's one or two that I think are struggling, and we're doing everything in our power to support them, help them, and make sure that they like it enough to come back next year. Because if you're a really good youth coach, that's your sole focus, is to just make sure they have enough fun and they learn enough skills so that they can come back next year and compete. That podcast is coming right up. First up, let me tell you about a couple of our resource partners.
I'd like you to consider for just a moment that more than half of the people who are listening to the sound of my voice will have a heart attack, stroke, or heart failure in their lifetime. However, research shows us that up to 90% of heart disease and stroke is preventable. I think about my own father who died by heart attack at just 47 years old, and I wonder how much longer he'd be around if we'd just known about Health Span MD. Dr. Todd Hurst, a board-certified cardiologist, is not just my doctor. He's helped thousands of people just like you and me with his approach. HealthSpan MD is the way healthcare is supposed to be, an ongoing partnership between you and your expert healthcare team that guides you step-by-step on the best opportunities to achieve your health, weight, and longevity goals. Please take a minute and sign up for his three-step consultation and witness the HealthSpan MD difference for yourself so you can be here longer for your family and, most importantly, yourself. HealthSpanMD.com.
HealthSpan MD, an insurance-based practice.
Looking for no bullshit conversation about mental health? Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcasts. Search it using all one word. Learn from people who lived it.
Welcome to another episode of Learn from People Who Lived It.
So you guys all know that I'm a youth coach, and every single day I see it. I see the way parents treat it. I see the way youth coaches treat it. And most importantly, I see the way that kids receive it. If you pay attention, you can see it in their faces. You can see it in their body language. Yes, sports are awesome. Yes, sports are indeed fun and a great way to teach some invaluable lessons. But there is also a downside to sports. Or maybe a better way to say that is there's opportunities for improvement. And that's why today's guest is going to be such a great conversation. Welcome to Learn From People Who Lived It. This is Luis Fernando Llosa in New York City. How are you, pal?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it, Matthew.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. I've got the, this is the show on the road, man. The whole family came to Palm Springs for the Thanksgiving holiday. And so I'm on my on the road setup, if you will, today.
Love it. I think I see either a badminton or a volleyball court way behind you.
There's all kinds of stuff happening, man. This backyard is a circus waiting for all the kids to get home and have a ton of fun. Well, listen, how did you get started in this? I mean, I know you worked for Sports Illustrated for a while, so you've always been in and around sports, but at what point in your life do you decide to sort of take this little pivot and get a little bit more investigative and then get more of your energy focused on riding the ship, if you will?
Wow. So it's a big question because it's literally, you know, a life path for me. But I started at Fortune Magazine and then at Money Magazine early on in my journalism career, but I was looking for the story and for people in the stories. That's what I cared about. And so, you know, touting mutual funds or talking about how businesses can do better wasn't really my thing. And I realized pretty quickly, because I was at Time Incorporated, that the opportunities for long form great writing were in sports. Sports Illustrated did it better than anybody else on the planet back then. You know, they would send a guy who could embed himself with an athlete or with a team or in a situation in another country and hang out and then write a sort of larger piece about that athlete, their life, the psychology of their, how they became who they are, or about a trend or a situation. Like, for example, one that I didn't write but worked on early on when I was there as a researcher was Who's Coaching Your Kid? Mm-hmm. Right? Pertinent to what we're talking about. Sadly, it was about sexual abuse in sports, which has always been a problem to some degree, but it was a major story back then, which got picked up by Oprah. So the writers were on Oprah, and that was the kind of societal and impactful story that I got to work on. And then sort of it just happened. I speak fluent Spanish. I'm Peruvian. A little kid named Danny Almonte was pitching in the Little League World Series and stunning everybody. He had a complete game, an almost perfect game, winning at Williamsport, still winning, beating teams that were you know, phenomenal from Florida, from Japan. And he was from the South Bronx, a mostly all Latino team. And he was just a phenom, and he was pitching at a speed hadn't been seen. He was just confusing everybody. And I just so happens, as he was doing this, I had flown down to the Dominican Republic to look into possible age fraud amongst Pedro Martinez, Sammy Sosa, all the biggest names in the history of baseball from the Dominican Republic, who were then killing it in the league, in the bigs, right? And I was with somebody there who was helping me, who knew the system down there and how things worked and how birth certificates were created. And there were different copies in different in the main town in the city of Santo Domingo and in the town where you were born. And so as I was down there, my editor said, "Hey, I'm hearing from the Florida. It probably sour grapes, but we're hearing from the Florida team that this kid may be older than he says, and that's why he's so good." And I looked into it, and I found another birth certificate for him that put him at 14, not 12. So when you're 12, 11, 10 in Little League and a 14-year-old is hurtling at you, it's a big difference. From 60 feet, it's almost insurmountable.
Yeah, listen, I coach youth hockey, right? And so, but I'm in high school hockey, and the difference between my kids at JV and my seniors who are nearly grown men, it's very, very different.
It's huge. Wow. And it's also some kids grow up faster than others, so you can have a kid. I know of kids who are in ninth grade are really kind of smallish and not cutting it, even though they have all this talent and skill. And by 12th grade, if the coach didn't like invest with them, they're now like three times as fast, twice as big. And if they had just worked with them, they would have an incredible senior playing on their team. But often they don't, or the kid quits discouraged. Anyway, that was it for me, seeing a father and a coach manager basically abuse a kid who knew he was lying. And he ends up being on the cover in Time Magazine, on the cover of the Daily News, on the cover of the New York Times above the fold, on the cover of the New York Post as this phenom. And 2 days later, we're coming out with my story that says that he's a fraud. As I was arriving in a taxi driving home from the airport from this trip where I discovered this, Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, who back then was just as intense but a little more put together, was giving this kid and the team the keys to the city. So the story broke. They still gave him the keys to the city. Go figure. But anyway, that was my serious introduction to youth sports gone awry. Then I continued to investigate supplement use and steroid use in Major League Baseball, in World Championship Boxing, in the Olympics, and in wrestling as well. And that's when I talked to the parents of kids who'd committed suicide while cycling off of steroids at the ages of 16 or 17 as sophomores and juniors in high school. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I came hard on the argument that kids, that athletes should be able to do what they want because it's their body and they make more money. In other words, no, you can't, because you're an example to the kids and they'll do what you do. And a 15, 16, 17 year, 18 year old trying to become you, even though, you know, 1% of 1% will, they're doing it and they're taking these drugs and it's dangerous for them.
Yeah. And
it's not good.
Man, there's so many things about what you just said that are so bothersome and so troubling, right? And one of the things I was thinking about as you were explaining this Danny Monte story was, you know, it would be easy for people to be like, yo, why are you picking on this kid? And it's like, we're not picking on this kid. We're picking on all these adults around him who created a system that puts him in this position. No sensible adult would put a child in that situation unless winning was the only thing that mattered.
Correct. And in the DR, in some ways it is, because if this kid goes to the bigs, he can lift a family of 20 to 30 people up out of poverty. But that's too much pressure for a kid. And we're doing it to kids in middle class and upper middle class. You go to you go to Stanford and Darien, Connecticut, and you've got hedge fund manager pops who are putting that kind of pressure on their son or daughter who doesn't need to become the greatest squash player of all time or the best lacrosse goalie, you know, in collegiate history. But they're putting the pressure on them because it's what they think they want or what they want to live vicariously through. It's very sad. And it all boils down to, like, we need to get our own sports biography and just general biography straight in ourselves, either before we parent or as we're parenting, so that we don't push our life, our path, our mistakes, and our hope, you know, our wish to correct what we didn't do onto our kids. Cause that's probably that's hubris, which means missing the mark. It's sin.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's horrible. It's horrible to do that to kids.
Yeah. Okay. So I mentioned it up front. There's a lot of opportunities for progress here. And there's a lot of really great things being done. I myself am a hockey coach, and USA Hockey has done a ton of work on safe sport and training. And now, even to be a youth hockey coach, you have to watch, you know, 4 hours worth of videos and go through concussion training and watch videos from sports psychologists to get better at, you know, but still there's too many of these coaches who are in it to win it and win at all cost. And then to take it even further than that, the thing that I think bothers me the most, if there's one thing that I'm bothered by the most in sports, it's that we have too many old school coaches still in the game. And there's not enough people.
20 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. There's not enough new school coaching where we kind of are, and you don't have to get it all, but like start to buy into this thing that we're talking about, which is, what are we doing here? And so I want to ask you from your vantage point, Luis, like, what are the opportunities for progress? If I've got a four-year-old and, you know, it's time to sign them up for their first little league or soccer match or hockey or whatever that's going to be for them, what should I be thinking about?
Wow, that's a big question. So in Beyond Winning, we go deep into when it's too early, what to do, how to choose the best coach, at what age-appropriate sort of development in sport. And to be candid, four is even too young to consider organized sports. We have several in the chapters. We have this whole, we break down sort of like the positive and the negative of organized sports. and hyper training. And for the parent who is like set on developing their kid into a really good athlete that's competitive at a higher level, what you do if you put your kid in command-oriented sports, organized sports early, is you choke off the potential for creativity. The kid will learn how to follow orders, do drills the way they're supposed to, trap the ball in this way, you know, take this slap shot this way, make a pass at this moment, but they won't do what Wayne Gretzky does, which is have 360 vision and be able to handle anything at all times. So how did Wayne Gretzky, this is for the parent who's like set on their kid being wonderful. Cause right. there's a way to look at this for every type of parent. Right. But for that parent, that's really pushy and wants their kid to play collegiate or to get it to the highest level of high school, what I argue for with them is don't put your kids into sports too early. And everybody's talking about specialization. Everybody thinks if you don't put your kid in at 6, 7, 8 on this track, that track, they won't be good enough. The fact is, if they're athletic, they'll be able to develop and will develop better playing multiple sports. How did Wayne Gretzky learn how to be so creative and so different from the rest on ponds? He played pond hockey. He didn't play organized youth hockey. And in a pond, the ice is a little bit bumpy, right? There's a goal there, but when you miss, that puck travels from.
You got to go get it.
So you like to try. So you start to shoot low and shoot as more accurately as you can.
Right, right.
You have to handle the difficulties of the surface of what's going on. You may be playing with kids who are really big and also little, so you have to adjust and be nicer. The pass to the little kid has to be pretty precise. You have to avoid the big kid or win against him, and that's a challenge. So you're learning all these different kind of flexibility. Then you look at Diego Maradona or Pele or Messi, and these guys learned also on the streets. Messi learned in a confined little space where they played Fulbito, which was on cement mostly. Then he started, you know, earlier than the others, he started getting into formal training through Barcelona. But Diego Maradona did not. And Pele was playing with rolled up rags, you know, as soccer balls. All these Dominican guys who are fantastic hitters were first playing with broomsticks and chapas, which are the little when you have an old style Coca-Cola or a beer, let's say, and you open it up, that top was what was being thrown to them. And they were like watching it go like this and then hitting it. So that's how they developed the great eye-hand coordination. And in soccer, if you're playing with kids of all ages and adults and you're having fun and you're doing crazy stuff and trying stuff, then you're learning a lot more with your body, how to move, how to do stuff. Whereas if you're at age 4, 5, 6 going to soccer camp on a soccer team, on a travel team, they're teaching you a systematized way to play. And that chokes off your creativity. Now, you say, that's great. Luis has some experience. He's coached for 25 years. He knows soccer. Does that apply to other sports? Well, you know, it applies with hockey. But what I did in researching our section of Beyond Winning called The Power of Play was I flew down and met with University of North Carolina lacrosse NCAA coach Jenny Levy, women's lacrosse. When I got there, she had just won her first championship, national championship. Interviewing her, she told me, Luis, first of all, she showed me her bookshelf. It had The Zen of Coaching. It had dozens and dozens of books on how to be a better coach. What does that tell you? She's constantly thinking, I'm lacking here. I'm not connecting with that kid there. It's got to be me, not them. And how do I adapt? And so what would she do? When I saw her, we filmed her practices. She would have, they're playing lacrosse with the lacrosse ball. It's all set up normally. Then she would throw in a tennis ball, wiffle balls. All of it changes. Like you whip a wiffle ball, it travels differently. It's lighter. Tennis ball is different. then she would say, okay, we have the two goals here. Well, let's turn one of them that way. So now when you're going, you have to go behind to score. It changes lacrosse completely because, yes, there's playing behind, like in hockey, right? Imagine if you did that with hockey, if you faced the goal the other way. Well, what it does is it makes the whole team have to change, shift, adapt in a moment. And what if you just put – you have the two goals here. Now you put a goal in the middle. Now they have to they have to defend that goal too, or they can score that way. And so it makes them skate differently, think differently, develop differently. So – but before you even get to that stage where you have a coach that's that creative and that smart and knows how to expand the minds and the bodies and the body movement of their players, you get to the most important thing that people talk about in psychology, child development, early childhood development, and then teenage development, which is free play. Free play. I'm not necessarily saying pick up basketball, although that is free play, but just goofing around and laser tag, climbing,
kickball, right?
Ball, anything. And what happens in those scenarios when there are no adults present is magical. And it's magical on many levels. It's magical in terms of flexibility and adaptability, but also how to deal socially with other kids. So like the example I often give is if you're playing a game and one kid wants to be goalie, but he's not a very good goalie, but it's his ball. And you say, no, you can't be goalie. And he says, I'm going to leave. And he starts walking away. So now the kids are, hold on. Okay, you can play goalie, but why don't you play for the first half? And then we'll have another goalie and we'll put this guy as a defender. And so now they're negotiating with each other. They're thinking things through. They're developing skills that will actually help them when they're at work in jobs. And that all happens in situations where they're not controlled and governed by adults. I've watched this in real time, and I've watched kids having an amazing time and fighting and arguing because, hey, the three best players are on that team and that doesn't work. So why don't you spot us three goals, or one of them has to come and play with us. And they figure all that out. And then they're having a great time. And then a parent comes and maybe there's a bit of a dust up and they swoop in and they start taking absolute control and say, all right, you have to go there. We're going to make some rules. And these are the kids are learning, adapting, creating their own rules. So they're learning how to think and create a system for themselves that works among them. Parents come in and blow that up because they want to control everything and they think they know better. Right.
Oh, of course. I mean, the control piece is the biggest thing that coaches have to let go of. There is so much amazing things that happen in chaos. And here's the thing. It looks like chaos to us. It's not to them. They got it. They're all on the same page. They know what's going on. And so here I'm compelled to ask you this question, and not for the benefit of me, but for the people that are listening to our podcast right now, because there has to be some balance there, right? Like we have coaches in play to in some way structure what's going on, but there has to be this balance of letting the kids mostly do it and getting out of their way. But then, knowing when to put yourself into the mix, there's no perfect science there, but what have you seen? Again, getting back to this idea of there's opportunities for progress here. So what are those opportunities? When do we jump in?
Absolutely. So first of all, if we really study age appropriate interaction and activity,
yes,
right, then we realize that free play from ages about 3, 4, 5 to 6, 7, 8, 9 is critical, and even up to 12.
Yes.
But organized sport shouldn't really occur. To be honest with you, in an ideal world, until kids are 11 or 12. And in an ideal world, even then, it's not the adultified league game structure. In Chapter 8, we go into all of this. Kids don't need to wear team uniforms and beat other teams and be in national championships in Taekwondo at the age of 7 or 9 or lacrosse or even hockey. What they need to do is learn movement skills. So you can have games and competition. But this whole thing of, and I'm a parent, I've had 5 kids, I love watching every second of every game. But is it for me or for them? So for them, when they're younger, they don't really need to compete with each other. They need to compete with themselves and develop athletically. Mm. So we could, this is like rip up the whole system and create a new paradigm. And it's done in Europe, in some places that have had good success with it. I remember talking to a coach who was from Colorado, who said that in the main soccer association there, they had realized that having kids at 8 in playing in leagues against each other and teams traveling was not good for the kids. So they would set them up and just teach them and learn and give them self-measurement. Now, when should a coach step in? In the younger years, just to govern, just to make sure nobody's getting hurt and to do, give a little bit of instruction. But by the age of 11, 12, now your coach is actually teaching you sports-specific skills and helping you. And that's great. And that's good. But when you go to a practice and you can tell, like for me, the litmus test, one of the clear litmus tests of how good a coach is whether it's football, baseball, basketball, hockey, any sport, is what's going on in that hour, hour and a half that they have with the kids. How much time are they spending talking to the kids in a circle? Like, we got to do this, we got to do that. Joey, be quiet, all that stuff. If you can't get your kids quiet, it's on you, not them. If you set up dynamic practices where everybody's active at all times. So what Scott did when he developed a system of youth football for the NFL is in 8 different cities in disadvantaged neighborhoods, he would have practices have 8 stations. So you were doing something at all times. You might have a minute break, but then you'd be doing something else that was cool. The kids loved it.
Yeah.
It was structured. It was teaching them sports specific skills, but it wasn't an adult talking to them. It was them doing through learning. And so that's what I prefer to see. A coach that organizes their practices really well, that sets up stations, and then that comes in to instruct. Hold on, guys, in station 3. Actually, turn your body a little more and receive the ball with sensitivity by pulling back as it touches you, and then do a hammer pass, which is with the middle of the side of your foot. You know, showing them and then letting them mess up. One thing I learned, because I was a very enthusiastic, overexcited type of coach, was if you're going to point out one thing wrong, point out 3 things right. You know, you as a coach can see, as a hockey coach, you can see the 7 thing the kid's doing absolutely wrong, even just with his slap shot or with his skating. But if you overwhelm him with that instruction, you're going to just make him shrink instead of, you know, get bigger and embrace what he's doing. So you teach him one, you step in, you correct one thing, and you leave the rest for the next day or the next week. So
because you understand, can I just interrupt? Because you understand, if you're any kind of coach with knowledge, you know that a fully developed athlete is 28 years old.
Wow. Like,
so they don't have to be incredible at 12, 16, 18.
No.
And they sure as hell don't have to be good at 8. They don't have to be anywhere close to that. So back to you, because I think that's what we get so wrong. We have this short-term vision and we think, well, I got to win my little league playoffs this year. Do you really have to win?
And you know that, like, in every sport, there's championships, and the kids say, yeah, we won the national championship. How is it that in a sport, like, let's say, I don't know, soccer, let's say, that there are like 740 national championships? Like, isn't a national championship when the top 2 teams in the entire country, right? Well, it's just a marketing thing between, you know, little leagues in different places, and it's not real.
Yeah.
And it doesn't help them. So, when we wrote this book, things were pretty shitty across the board. Scott would tell you that youth sports was toxic.
Oh,
Kim would tell you that everything he'd seen in Australia and then here in the U.S. and in England was no good. Scott was an elite running athlete at Syracuse. Kim was an elite athlete in soccer and swimming in Australia. That's why, you know, we said smart parenting in a toxic sports environment. Here's the positive.
Okay.
The positive is, since then, as you saw in hockey, they realized that kids who are 12, 13, 14 banging each other up on the boards, or even hitting each other, not smart.
Yeah.
A lot of kids quit. Every kid who isn't like a huge early on quits. I was just talking to a friend of mine in Whitby, Ontario, which is as hockey country as you can get.
I was going to say, yeah.
They're in Canada. And his middle kid grew a little later and he quit hockey because he didn't want to do the checking at 15, 16.
Right.
I get it. But there's been an improvement in football. Sometimes you see on YouTube clips of parents hitting 8-year-old kids, banging them up to get them tougher. That's really sick and sad. But mostly an awareness has grown. And places like the Center for Healing Injustice Through Sport have come up. Megan Bartlett is a good friend of mine, founded that out of Boston about 11, 12 years ago. And she goes around teaching social emotional intelligence to coaches so that they can deal with kids who have ADHD or other challenges.
Yes.
Or are just difficult. Because if you're a coach today, you're noticing that a lot of your kids are acting in ways that you don't remember that you acted in front of a coach. They're
sure.
acting, you know, ADHD. So I know of a kid who just wouldn't look at the coach. And the coach is like, look at me.
Right.
You know, the old school is like, when I talk, you guys listen. Look at me. Tony, look at me. Why can't you look at me? And so he's like angry at Tony. And then it's like soon after emails are fired around and he's like, he's uncoachable. He's off the team. I can't deal with him because he creates these problems. And then I have to focus on him. And then the other 15 kids don't get enough of my time. If that coach had known that kids with ADHD or certain social anxiety are listening to every word you say, can repeat it to you verbatim if you ask, but just are shy and can't look directly at you, he could have coached that kid in a totally different way.
Yeah.
And the other example I like to give, because it happened to me a couple of times, is when you have a kid who is kind of like a bit of a bully to the others because he's accelerated, like he's the kid who can score from anywhere, who's maybe the fastest skater, a great passer, and he's telling you, Coach, I don't know, they call you Coach Matt, Coach Matthew.
Yeah, at the rink, it's always Coach Matt, you bet.
So Coach Matt, like, why do you even put him in? Because, like, if you just left me in 2 more minutes, I would have scored 2 more goals and we won that game. Or Coach Matt, I'm not going to pass to him anymore because every time I pass to him, he messes up. A good Coach Matt says, you know what? If you pass to him, it's like you score. And he scores. If you help him score, that's 2 goals for you. I'm going to put up 2 goals for you. Because anyway, those kinds of hyper-aggressive kids can become, through sport, real assholes and real bullies in the future. And then take that into corporate America and, you know, cut up their teams, be terrible leaders for that reason. Or with that same kid, if you as a coach perceive them that way and put them in charge of younger kids, say, I want you, because the other kids on their team don't like that kid. They're
right.
not liked. They may be popular in the sense that they're successful and help them win, but they're not liked. So they're bullies, but they're in a way being socially excluded themselves. And the best way to bring them into the fold and to teach them empathy is to get them to coach a 2 or 3 year younger division. Because in that scenario, when they're rude to the kid, it's like, I just showed you how to do it, man. It's easy. You just flick that way and hit your wrist. And then the little kid doesn't do it right. So he says, dude, you suck. And then the kid starts to cry. And then he goes to you and says, Coach Matt, he's mean. I hate him. I don't want him to coach me anymore. Then that kid starts to feel his own failure. Like you would put him in charge of helping coach younger kids and he's failing. So he starts to realize he needs to socially adjust to each situation and be more encouraging with the kid. Wow. The lessons he's learning for the rest of his life on how to handle and teach and coach and mentor are humongous.
Yeah.
But in most situations, a coach will simply just, you know, counsel that kid off the team or feed his ego and his parents' ego and handle the fallout instead of a life teaching moment. But what you do if you do nothing there is you help create an entitlement monster.
There it is, man.
And the impact is vast, because if we don't think that what the kids are learning in sports is impactful on a higher level with society in general, then we're not taking into account that I think the statistic from Ernst & Young study is that only, I think, something like 5% of the upper level CEO level corporate America is women, and something like 90 something, I don't know if it's 95%, but something close to that, of those women who achieve that level of leadership in corporate America, they all played serious high school or college sports. So in that sense, sports is doing something right. It's helping create women who are confident in themselves, see their bodies as more than, you know, what they had been seen for millennia before, and are successful socially and emotionally and at a specific skill. And that kind of confidence grows and is applied throughout life.
Man, I've got a few questions that I want to throw out at you. And this is all stuff that I've seen along the way. And, you know, you'll meet these guys who are what I call old school dudes who don't want to shift their thinking, you know, and it's really hard to like pull them forward. And so the first question that I want to ask, and maybe you don't even have an answer to it, but it's like, what is the right way to eliminate these people from youth sports? How do we create some sort of standardization to where like there's a level you have to be at in order to coach and be around children? Because we do it for teachers. They have to get training. They have to go through classes. They have to get certification. And to a degree, we're doing it in hockey a little bit with USA Hockey and all the training that we have to do. But you and I both know, man, there's still so many coaches who are out there reliving their glory days through these kids. And I wonder if there's a way to get them to just quit. Or,
well, I mean, so I'm just riffing off what you're saying right now.
Yeah.
I haven't given like getting rid of the old guard specific strategic thought yet.
Yeah.
I just thought maybe the old guard would sort of move on through, you know,
age out
their time or whatever.
Yeah.
Mother time, whatever it is.
Right.
But one way to do it is they don't like to be told that they're wrong. They don't like to do new stuff. So as you said, in youth hockey, there is now, you know, hours that have to be done. You know, you have to watch video. You have to learn teaching, telling them that they have to take empathy courses, social, you know, social dynamic or bullying and teasing courses, how to handle kids in different ways that have ADHD, they're going to want to quit because they don't want to do that stuff.
Yeah,
they
good
think
point.
They're right. So you can push them out just by saying now there are these three different courses you have to take in order to be qualified to work with kids. And when they say, yeah, well, whatever, you can say, well, we have sexual harassment problems. We have lawsuits. So this is real, dude. You have to take these courses if you want to continue to be allowed to coach. Which, by the way, means that there has to be, like in USA Hockey, a structure imposed. The issue has been that there are no structures anywhere. There's associations, but their boards are made of the old school.
I know.
Anyway, so Scott tried to change some rules in punt returns and a few other aspects of football 15, 20 years ago with the National Youth Football Association level people. And they went crazy on him and they wouldn't do it. Now, of course, even the NFL is considering and applying new changes in how to tackle, when to tackle, and how punt returns are set up and what's allowed and what isn't. So there's good stuff happening everywhere. This is a bit tangential, but I've learned about in Seattle, a group of kids, teenagers, Ultimate Frisbee, it's all girls and they run themselves. There's no adult coaching. That's pretty cool.
I love that.
Peer mentorship, right?
Yeah, because I've often thought about showing up at one of my hockey practices one morning and just saying to the guys, here's the pucks. You guys got practice today. Whatever you want to do, I totally support it. You tell me what I can do to help you, but you guys got the drills today. And then literally go sit on the bench and just facilitate where I need to.
So you haven't tried it yet, right?
No. I'm absolutely just kind of started to entertain the idea in the last few weeks.
I love that. I mean, I would say go for it.
Yeah.
Creating as you've already thought of, I'm sure, enough of a safety issue that guys, you guys are going to rotate as coaches, as you know, you're going to set up your own drills. You can do some stuff creative and a few of the things that we always do. But also, guys, if there's a problem that you guys can't sort out, I'm going to come out. Otherwise, I'm just going to watch. And I'm not watching and judging you. I'm not taking notes to see who's going to play more time in the next game because they've done this in a more dynamic way. I'm just here to generally just keep an eye on stuff. But I'm excited to see what you guys can do. So it's not a, you know, it's not a competition. They don't think that they're judging you, but that would be awesome. And that would be,
I'll let you know how it goes.
That would be a podcast right there to just say, here's what happened. Right. But,
the old school coach's mind, by the way, just exploded because how can I show up to practice without my four stations and my five regroup drills and all of that shit? Right.
Well, it's self-importance, right?
Yes, coaches, of course.
Ego-driven coaches think that they're the key, and we're just supposed to be facilitating and teaching, but teaching, you know, in a involved, detached compendium, not, you know, in there always orchestrating. So getting out of the way of our athletes, creating more peer mentoring structures, having kids start organized sports a little later, but creating fun, dynamic ways that they can coach each other and learn movement stuff in the earlier stages. All these sort of suggestions have been done to a certain degree in some places, but they could really help. And the other thing is, not having the sort of adult oriented structure early on. We mentioned that a little earlier, right? Because points and teams and jerseys is all about selling jerseys and selling hotel rooms and all that stuff. When you can learn it all right here in your own town. And also, every hour you're spending in a car is an hour that you're not connecting really with your kids.
Yeah, that's the truth, that's, man.
The other thing we say in the book a lot is you are your child's first coach, right? And that's critical. And a kid at four, a kid at six or seven or eight would rather play football with his mom because maybe she's a single mom, or maybe the dad's out of the picture or can't, would rather throw a football with their mom who has a wobbly throw and who hasn't learned how to throw well, but is starting to because she wants to play with you and have fun out there and connect with his or her parent than be playing with and for other people. So the key thing is hold them tight and close and connect with them. And there are a bunch of things that are coming through my mind about this that we address in the book as well, which have to do with, you know, women sometimes thinking, well, I didn't play that sport, so I don't know anything about it. That could be the ideal coach for those kids.
Right.
And we do actually feature Ixmara in chapter 8, a coach who she coached football, peewee football, having never coached before. And how did she do it? And this goes to your old school situation. She bought 6 books on like football for dummies, how to coach young kids, all these. And she read them all. Wow. Open-minded. That's nice. Cause all the old school guys are not open-minded. So you say, well, how could she teach fundamentals? She doesn't know stuff. That's her assistant coach. So she's got the team. She's understanding the social impact. She's helping kids feel better, and she's also motivating them and teaching them and helping them peer mentor each other, knowing when to move in and help when the kid is hurt or when to back off and let them resolve things on their own. And if she doesn't have sports specific understanding, then her assistant coach can help. But that female coach can do a greater job than. And she was in her league. The kids loved her. Kids wanted to play in it. They all signed up the next year. Whereas some of the rough and tumble, meaner old school guys, you know, had trouble keeping kids on their team. So, and of course, that's kind of even old school thinking that I just laid out for you, because so many women have now spent their own youth in sports that they don't have to worry about reading, you know, basketball for dummies, because they actually learned how to play it and are great coaches themselves.
Right, right.
Or the problem has been the paradigm of mom's in charge of snacks and who gets rides to the youth sports event, and dad is going to fill in as the coach. So one woman who I recently met set up with football. I'm trying to remember her association now. It's in California, in near Oakland and San Francisco in the Bay Area. It's an organization for women coaches of youth football.
Okay.
Because her husband died, and she has two daughters, and they wanted to coach, and they wanted to learn. And so flag football all over the place. So all this stuff is happening here and there, but it could be happening everywhere, and that would be wonderful.
Yeah. What do you say to the guys who, and the girls too, who are like, well, hold on a second. Like, what about these people who are going to become, you know, the elite athletes in their sport? At what point do we get very direct with them and make sure they understand systems and make sure we're elevating their skills to the max? And so I think I know the answer with regard to hockey, but I'd love to know what you and your research has kind of figured out. What is that age where it's okay to start pushing them a lot harder and correcting a little bit more than you would when they're younger?
Absolutely. So one of the things to fall back on is the human body.
Yes. Right?
We're pushing girls ages like 9 to 11, 12 into intense training in basketball and soccer, and their knees are blowing out at alarming rates. We're pushing boys too early in, you know, only hockey or only basketball or only soccer. And it's the same movement and the same training for the same movements, and it's putting too much stress, or with baseball, and they're blowing out their elbows and their knees as well. And I'm talking about reconstruction surgery, like stuff that is with them for the rest of their lives. So to my mind, and what we write about in the book as well, having consulted, orthopedic folk and Scott's a nationally well-known trainer. It's when your body is matured a bit, and for girls it's 13, 14, maybe even 15, but for boys it's 15, 16. I mean, some boys maybe 14, but it's basically at that point that they can go specific. But even then, they shouldn't only play football or hockey or soccer.
Right.
And
right.
We have an organization called Whole Child Sports.
Yes. Whole talk about
Child
it.
Sports. It's wholechildsports.com. If you go on that site in our toolkit, you'll see like the 10 tenets of a whole youth sport experience. And you'll see the four stages of play. And there we lay out when it's best to do the different things. But one of the key tenets is never play a sport all year round. Play three seasons and then rest for the fourth. And by right. rest, it means find other activities that don't mimic the same movement. So if you're playing basketball where you're sliding like this and you're running a lot on a hard surface, and if you're playing soccer, which is also moving around and putting stress on your knees in a similar way, you know, backpedaling and all that stuff, then it's mountain biking, or it's hiking, or it's something else, swimming, kayaking for the fourth season, giving your body a break. But even for the elites at 15, 16, 17, 18, it's also in how you pace them through a simple day, weekend, or week. So when you go to some of these tournaments, you've got kids, I'll just pick soccer. I'll just pick soccer because I know it, that they have a game at 11 a.m. and one at 3. And it's elite level. Like it's, you know, showcase like we're college coaches. But kids should only play one of those games a day. They need time to recover. And they certainly shouldn't play two. And so I know of a kid who played on my son's team, which was a pretty competitive team. This kid loves soccer. And he was playing on our travel team, which was intense, four practices a week, tournaments, college showcases. Unbeknownst to me, he was also playing on another team. So on the weekends when we weren't at major tournaments, he was flying with this other team all over the country playing for them. And he was playing pickup on the off hours and on weekends. And in a way, that's great. He's honing his sport. He's getting better and better. He's competing more and more. But guess what happened to him in his senior year? Just as he was going into where he could actually show coaches what he was made of, and he was getting looks. He was a center defender, and we need those always. He blew everything out in his hip.
And he had I was going to suggest maybe he burned out, but his body burned out. It wasn't even like he had a chance to mentally burn out. His body said, tapping out, friend.
And now, in a worst-case scenario, I'm not saying it's his case.
Right.
But if that happens to him, he can start taking painkillers and then cycle into a whole nother world of social pain and mental pain. So there are repercussions for all of this. There is a story in Beyond Winning that we have where we have a little kid who's playing lacrosse. He's either 9 or 10, and he's in the doctor's office, orthopedic surgeon's office. I mean, I interviewed the orthopedic surgeon. This was, he was a source for this. And the kid and the mom and dad are there, and the kid is saying he has this incredible pain in his knee. And then the dad goes off to make a phone call, and the mom gets on her knees and begs the orthopedic surgeon, who is saying, I can't find anything wrong with this kid's knee. There's nothing wrong. Basically, he's faking this. The mom begs the orthopedic surgeon to say that he has to not play lacrosse, not go to the camp on March break for at least 2 or 3 months in order to recover. They basically want him to lie to the dad so that they can get some space from him and his intensity on the kid. And the kid is 9 years old. He wants to quit everything. And this is what we're dealing with on one end. But there are all these horror stories. And back when we were writing this book, it was horror after horror after horror. Sorry, my throat's good.
Yeah, go ahead and take a drink, man. Don't worry.
But the fact is, things are getting better. More people are aware.
Yes.
But the really intense, crazy parents are still out there. And we can't necessarily go straight at them to stop them from doing this, because they often feel like they're right. I had a mom who said she loved the idea of our book and about taking it slow and not too fast, too soon. And the conversation developed, and she sounded like the perfect mom, doing things age appropriately, not introducing things too intensely. But then while I dig a little deeper in our conversation, she says they're spending $65,000 a year for their two kids from the, you know, Montclair, near Montclair, New Jersey, Saddle River, where there's a lot of money. You know, it's a very wealthy area in New Jersey. They're spending $65,000 a year for them to fly to different hockey tournaments.
Wow.
So she sounded to me, in how she was speaking, like the ideal mom, not pushing her kids. But as I got deeper into the conversation, I realized she was actually the epitome of what's wrong with parents.
So I want to wind down here in the next 10 minutes. And so let's here's the question. Okay. How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. So this thing we're facing is an elephant, and it's sort of, I don't know what the word is, but impossible is kind of what comes to mind. It's going to be impossible to tackle all of these things at once and get them all right. This is clearly a marathon, and we're going to be on this journey for a long time because it took us a while to get to this place. So let's do three. People can handle three things. Give me three things parents specifically should be thinking about. And if they're seeing these things in their youth sports and, you know, through their children or whatever, they should be sounding the alarm to associations, coaches, other parents, and going, you know what, hold on, time out. This is not what it's about. And it may be some of the stuff that we've already covered here. But as we wrap up, three things that we can start doing immediately as a parent.
Okay. All right. So one of them is to take a good look at the coach and see if they chose the right coach for their kid.
Okay.
And the key there is that coach ego driven? Are they focusing on winning only? Are they yelling at the kids, dressing them down publicly in front of other kids and in front of the parents when they do something wrong? or are they building them up and encouraging them? Do they coach through yelling or through, I have a big voice when I'm coaching.
Sure.
But it was positive coaching. It was
amen.
Like, great job, Tony. You know, and not instructing, over instructing them, but letting them figure things out.
Yeah, I used to say, I'm not angry, I'm loud. I'm just, right. I'm not upset, I'm just loud.
And I've had my assistant coach, I tag team, when you see me getting overbearing or talking too much, just give me a, you know, we had a sign, like he would pinch me on the shoulder or give me a tap, and I would be like, oh, find myself, feel my legs on the grass, come to a calm and look at what's going on and
yeah.
see that it doesn't matter as much as I think it does, but that the kids are safe and have fun. So you are going to be able to tell pretty soon if a coach is like this. And another thing is, if you're afraid of your coach, things aren't
there.
Good.
It is. And they like, are. They're yeah. afraid
because, you know, oh, he's going to do this to my kid. And know that your coach is influencing your kid in a massive way.
Yes.
Because they're the leader of your kid's team and they look up to them. So if a coach is encouraging kids to go out there and bang people up, they're not the right coach.
Okay.
Playing hard and tough is okay. That's one anyway.
Okay. So check out the coach. That's number one. First thing is a parent.
And choosing, we have a list in the book on how to choose a coach.
Okay.
And what the signs are, like your question exactly, what the signs are of them being an ego-driven coach versus a coach that's healthy for your kid.
Okay.
I would say the second thing is for you as a parent to really dig into your own sports biography and figure out why you're here.
Yes.
If you're a dad who coaches, why are you coaching? Is that helping your own kid? Because that's – I love kids. I loved coaching kids. Sometimes my kids accuse me of, you know, being too kind to everybody and not focusing on them. But the fact is, of course, your kids come first, but all kids are great. But if you're coaching year after year, it may not be the best thing for your kid.
Yeah.
You know, and if you need to coach, maybe you should be coaching another team and let your kid experience other coaches who you vetted, or your wife is vetted, or your husband is vetted. But it may not be the best thing for them.
Sure. Sure.
But the whole sports biography is important. Like, and I've had people say, well, I don't have a sports biography. And you're wondering, like, what does he mean? What does Luis mean here? Basically, they never played sports. That's a sports biography. That's a very specific one. And it can be a very problematic one. Because what do some of these parents tell me? You know, I just find a coach who I think is good and I let them deal with it because I don't know anything about sports. So, wow, do you want to give your kids psychological, social, physical, intellectual development just over for free to a coach? You know, just hand them over? No, you want to make sure things are okay, that the coach isn't the wrong kind of coach, that your kid isn't deciding to quit because the coach is putting them down. You know, you can't claim that you don't know about sports, so you're just going to give your kids over. And so that's a non-sports biography is a very important, specific type of sports biography.
Yeah.
The ones that we know of, obviously, the most are the ones who are trying to live vicariously through their kids. So they were a tennis star, so their eldest daughter is becoming one. You know, and the mother maybe was a soccer star, so the younger kid is becoming a soccer star. Dad and sister go to the swim meet together every weekend, and mom and little boy, little guy go to their thing, and now you have a separation of the family, the unit, and that's not good. You know, we write about examples like this throughout the book, anecdotes about how families cope with or damage
tag team in the weekend, man.
Yeah. And so that's number two. A third would be, what's the social climate on that team between among the parents, and the coach, and among the kids? And you as a parent have a lot of influence there. Because if, let's say, let's just pick a group of a basketball team and a group of 13-year-old girls and a couple of new players on the team, and nobody's passing to them, and they're being shunned, and, you know, there's tacit exclusion going on, which you can't even tell because there's a team text, but now there's another like 8-person text for the girls who are cool and like each other and have known each other. You as a parent can set up social moments for the team that can bond them together. Going back to Jenny Levy, what did she do when recruiting her elite recruits arrived as freshmen? This is something that I've repeated several times because I love this story. How do you get a senior and a junior and a sophomore to even connect with this freshman who's a hotshot from some high school who thinks they're great or is very shy and nervous, either dynamic or in between? How do you get them to become a team? Because that's how you're going to win a national championship, by the way.
Right.
Through a great, a tight. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, what coaches don't realize is if they spend time on the social, they will get better performance. A mediocre team can win championships if that's what you want to do, if that's your focus. You know, in a way, going in the back door to the old school types who only want to win. Well, becoming a better social coach, a better psychological coach will help you. And so with these girls, have a bowling night. And when it happens, or a barbecue, or everybody goes to a movie. But when it happens, make sure that the kids are integrating, because that can be another theater for exclusion. An example from one of my son's own teams. There were some scholarship kids, and they were mostly from a different social economic situation. In New York City, they were mostly Latino, 5 or 6 kids, all very good athletes. And then there were the kids, the regular kids, and the ultra wealthy kids, because that's what you have on a team. I personally, when we were in North Carolina or other states for tournaments, would notice the 5 or 6 scholarship kids were all sitting in one table when we were watching the World Cup, and the other kids were in 3 other tables. And every single lunch and dinner, they were separated. So the first thing I did, because I didn't want to like force this upon everybody, is instead of sitting with the other dads who I love to hang out with at the parents' table, I sat with the scholarship kids. So it was me and 5 other kids, and we talked and hung out. And then another thing we did was, you know, for kids needed rides. So different kids would take different kids. And it's not just you and the same 2 kids riding together. Mix it up and take one of the kids who's in this group. And then the team started to integrate more. And for me, the thing that really touched my heart was one day, because I would like, I'm not the coach, but, you know, I'm a coach-oriented guy there. I would be like, where's my son? I don't know, find him. And I walked into a room and knocked and walked into the room where a group of 7 or 8 kids were playing, you know, FIFA or whatever. They're playing a video game at the hotel with the PlayStation that the kid had brought with him or whatever. And they were having a great time. How did I feel when I finally saw, because I'd seen it the other way so many times, that in that room there were 8 or 9 kids and 4 of them were scholarship kids. And the other 5 were the kids of the other families who are very advantaged, but they were all integrated together and having a fun. And it wasn't me walking into one room and seeing the 4 or 5 guys alone and the other guys in a separate room. That's what we need to do. So to recap, it's choosing the coach and monitoring them to make sure that they're the right people, person, human being to be involved in such an important tutelage and mentorship of your child along this journey, that they're safe, that they're decent, that they care about the people they are. So coaches are educators first and coaches second. So yeah, you're an educator, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I know what you mean.
If they're a sports specific person, they're educators of the human being. That number two, what was number two? Help me out here. The second part,
just take your sport. You said talked about.
Yep. Yeah. Understanding who you are and being careful to observe yourself and see how that's seeping its way into the decisions you're making for your kid or how you're treating them, because that can be either a great positive or a real negative if you're forcing them to do something that they don't want to do or you're living vicariously through them. And the third thing is you can have a great impact on your child's experience and all the kids on that team if you're helping build the social sphere of that team and not just worrying and focusing on your kid and are they the leading scorer and are they getting playing time? Wow. Imagine if all parents stopped thinking about scoring and playing time and started thinking about, hey, is this team socially vibrant and good together? And are they friendly and helping each other out? That would change things.
It would change things dramatically. I can't tell you how much I love this conversation. And I just, you know, what I feel compelled to say is, if you've been listening to us for the last hour and you've been going, oh man, like I do some of those things that you guys are talking about not being awesome. Hey, I used to too, right? When I got into youth sports, I made mistakes and I did some things that I had to come around on too. And I can only tell you how much better it is on the side that I'm at now, which is this 30,000 foot view of the way that things are going, and understanding that, I mean, you see these commercials every single NCAA tournament, right? I don't know what the stat is, but they talk about how little amount of the people actually keep playing sports after college. Most of us go on to get other kinds of jobs. And so just understanding that you can take small steps and just start to implement this stuff in, and, you know, don't be afraid to challenge these guys and gals who see it the old way, and just, but not in this way of like puffing your chest and say, do it my way. It's like, hey, I know what you want, but this isn't the way to get there. And I'll give you a classic example. And this is a hockey example that a lot of guys will know about, but you know, when a team's not having a good practice, the old school coach, Herb Brooks, right, from the Miracle, get on the line and do what they called Herbies, right? Blue line back, red line back, blue line back, goal line back. You're dead after one of those, right? Let alone have to do two or three of them. And the guys will all say, yeah, well, after that, they shaped up and they started listening to us. Yeah. You know what else they did? They started hating you. They started not wanting to do what you asked them to do, and literally kind of starting to break down in the locker room, and almost, you know what I mean? And it's so, just start to buy into this stuff, just little moments at a time. And incrementally, you'll look back in 3, 5, 7, 9 years and you'll be like, wow, you know, things are better. And the other thing is, when you can let go of this idea that you have to win every single game and every single year, it's a lot less pressure as a coach. Yep. And it's a little easier to do this thing when you're like, and a parent comes to you and they're like, hey, you know, because I still get it all the time. We have a couple of teams right now that are not having a very good season, right? They're losing right. A lot of games. And it's like, guys, this is the JV team. They're 14 years old. They're figuring things out. And if, you know, they get to D2 and they're not doing much better, well, then we'll start to talk. But then we get to D1. Don't worry about it. There's a lot in front of us.
Yeah, no, that's critical. Like for parents to be given the bigger view and coaches to see the bigger picture. And again, we're developing kids because, as you said, the percentage that actually get even to play D3, D1 sports in NCAA is tiny. As compared to all the kids who were going to the camps and showcases and ID camps, all that stuff that they were doing. And all those kids, you want them to continue to play sports and enjoy them. And then there's all the kids who weren't even necessarily that good at the sport, who got canceled out of sports activity because the town was putting all its resources into the club that was going into travel and had no rec stuff going on. And then there's a kid with disadvantages. One thing that I did with my travel team that got the best results for me ever, I think, was I had heard that there was a team there was a coaching going on a Saturday morning when we didn't have any games for kids who were seriously disadvantaged, like emotionally, physically, you know,
whatever.
And,
right.
And so I asked if my team, I was asked, hey, can a couple of your kids come and help out? I said, can my whole team go as a team? And they said, yeah, sure. So and it wasn't just go there once. We went for 6 Saturdays in a row. Mm-hmm. It was mandatory. Right. And our kids learned to work with kids who can't even pay attention for half a second, or who are walking across the wrong way, or are like picking flowers instead of defending the goal. And that was a way that, again, like that example of the kid who learns empathy when they're too good and they don't like playing with kids who aren't good enough. So you make them coach younger kids and they have to learn empathy. And that's a great lesson for them emotionally. And, you know, in terms of peer mentoring, the same thing happened with my kids. They really learned from those experiences. And it had never been done before. at the end of the season, they got an award for being like the most conscientious team. I thought that was a win, you know, like
huge win.
That was it. They were standing on a stage with all the parents of a 4,000 kid league clapping and getting their little trophies for having done something that we didn't expect that to be the end result, but that's what the commissioner decided to do with us. But that was like, wow. But the learning was in on those Saturdays when kids were kind of doing something that they weren't used to doing. It was a little uncomfortable. And then they realized, wow, I love these kids that I'm coaching and that I'm teaching. And it's fun and it's hard and it's interesting and it's challenging. And they learned a great deal from it. Yeah, you've hit it on the head of the nail.
Man. All right. Listen, we'll link to all your books, man. I'll encourage everybody to check out the websites. All those links will be in our show notes for anybody that wants to check it out. And Louise, I can't thank you enough for coming on and having this conversation with me.
I can't thank you enough for putting all of this out into the world, you know, because we need guidance, all of us. And like you were saying earlier that we all make mistakes. I was red carded as a coach twice.
Sure.
And while I can justify the reasons, I was worried about safety of kids and the ref. On the other hand, I could have handled it better. And that's part of my journey years ago. Right. And, you know, I had a mom accuse me of bullying her kid. And that was really interesting to me because I'm somebody who then later wrote a book on bullying and who had always been the kind of coach that all the parents liked because I cared about and taught their kids and they liked me coaching. So I had to realize, okay, why is this kid doing this? This is a kid who I helped him buy equipment because he couldn't afford it. I was always telling him where the practice was. I was driving him to every single game. And for some reason, when I said, no, he has to figure out how to get to practice today on his own, it really triggered him. And he told his mom, this guy. And then, you know what I mean? So, wow.
Yeah.
You learn, you grow. And none of us, no matter who we are, what book we've written or what podcast we kill at every week, we all have to learn. And that's what Jenny Levy taught me too. She's now won 3 national championships as a lacrosse coach for women's lacrosse in the NCAA. And she's still fingering the books and learning how to create more dynamic practices. One year she hired an Olympic caliber, one of the best Olympic female lacrosse players in the world to teach her kids how to stick handle, how to fool around and do tricks, not like stick handling for the game, but to do tricks so that they can be more dexterous and be more fluid and
love it.
More fun. She told me that the recruits that she got every year were like overbred dogs. When I got that quote, it went right into the book at the top of that chapter. Great quote. A coach saying that her nationally sought after recruits were overbred dogs who had been command oriented since age 5.
Yes.
And didn't know how to have fun because she said to them, hey, girls, remember, you're thinking of doing this with your team, letting them run their own practice and see what they do. She said to the girls, guys, show me some stuff, have some fun, do whatever you want. And they froze. Mm-hmm. They couldn't do it. They were like, well, coach, do you want us to run a weave drill? Do you want us to, like, you know, run sprints and do, you know, interweaving passes? She's like, no, do whatever you want. Just have fun. Show me some skills.
Yes.
And they couldn't do it because they were overbred dogs from the age of 5.
Yeah. That's so funny, man. We're literally having that parallel right now. My hockey team, I've got one coach who's kind of like, we got to do it this way. And then I'm saying, we don't have to do it anyway. Right. The only thing that matters is that they buy into whatever they choose.
Right.
They just have to buy into it.
Yeah.
We don't need to tell them what to do. They just have to choose one thing and then do that together and they'll be fine, you know, in these particular places. Well, listen, man, I say it all the time, but to everybody, knowing gets in the way of learning. And if you're the one person who thinks you know it all, man, it will be so hard to change your mind. And so I just encourage people to let go of the fact that you do know some great things, but you could also learn some really great things.
Thank you very much, Matt. I really appreciate it.
All right, buddy. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
We have 3 goals with Learn from People Who Lived It. 1, to help you feel less alone. 2, encourage you to seek out a coach, a therapist, a church, anyone who can help you get through your journey and find some healing. 3, when you're ready, Share your story with us.
Find Learn From People Who Lived It, wherever you get podcasts. Search it using all one word, Learn From People Who Lived It.
At Metal Joe, they sell more than shirts. They sell apparel with a purpose. In fact, my favorite hoodie in my closet is a Metal Joe hoodie. They help out G.I. Joes to the average Joe's one t-shirt at a time. With every purchase, you help them support organizations that can provide services to help others get out of their heads and into their bodies through plant medicines, equine therapy, yoga, and other non-traditional mental health treatments. Link to them. Pick out your favorite t-shirt or hoodie right now at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com/resources.